I'd now like to turn the conference call with Ms. Trina Ray. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you. Well, welcome everyone to the Charm Telecon for October, Probing the Mysteries of Iapetus. This is a really, really exciting presentation that we have for you today. We had just an absolutely fabulous targeted Iapetus flyby just over a month ago or so, and very, very exciting, one of the only times that we'll see this body in the mission and the extended mission. So it was very exciting, and we have really a terrific set of scientists who are joining us here today. The presentation is online at its normal spot at saturn.jpl.nasa.gov, and we will probably go the full 2 hours, I would suspect, having five scientists online. And with that, we'll turn it over to is it you first, Amanda, or?
Yes, I'll give a brief intro to the Iapetus situation.
Okay.
Before we get into the results from this flyby. Right, so on page two, I'll go ahead and jump in here with what we knew about Iapetus going into the September 2007 flyby. We have known for a long time, since the discovery of Iapetus, in fact, that it has this really dramatic albedo dichotomy. So one hemisphere is very dark and one hemisphere is quite bright. And it's the leading hemisphere that is dark, and that is because Iapetus is tidally locked, so the one hemisphere is always facing the same direction, and that's the hemisphere that is facing the direction of motion in the Iapetus's orbit. And that's the very dark one, and nobody's known, and a lot of theories have been floating around about why that one hemisphere would be so dark and the other is so bright. And I think especially Tillman is going to talk more about some of these different theories in his section, so I won't go into the different theories too much right now, but basically the big two theories were that it's either exogenic, it's coming in from some external source and coating on the surface, coating the leading hemisphere, or it's endogenic, so it is somehow coming from within Iapetus and being emplaced from within by some geologic process. So just in general about Iapetus, it's the third largest moon of Saturn, and as I mentioned, it's tidally locked. The orbital period, it orbits way out past Hyperion, and the orbital period is about 79 days, and that's pretty slow, and that ends up being very important, as you'll hear more about from John Spencer. So The flyby that we're going to be mostly talking about today happened on September 10th, and that was our targeted flyby. But we did have a flyby of Iapetus that was more distant, and it wasn't officially a targeted flyby, back on December 31st of 2004, and that was at about 123,000 kilometers altitude, which is still pretty good. I mean, it's definitely still much closer than we've gotten other than this targeted flyby. And it gave us a really good view of that dark leading hemisphere, that low albedo leading hemisphere, and also the bright north polar region of the leading hemisphere. On the next slide, page three, you can see some of the key images that came out of that flyby. And the really good views that we got of this equatorial ridge, which were hinted at. The ridge was hinted at in Voyager images, but this really really illuminated the presence of this equatorial ridge that's within the dark terrain on that leading hemisphere right at the equator. And closer up images of that north polar region really sort of display this pattern that is really consistent with a ballistic emplacement of dark material from some external source, and this is shown through this sort of streaky pattern that's seen, and bright rims of craters that are facing the north polar direction, so they're in the sort of protected zone where if the dark material is coming in from outside, then maybe those would be zones where you wouldn't expect material to land. So on the next slide, what we're saying here is that, okay, so maybe the stuff is exogenic, but there is more to the story, and this is really what we're learning from this recent targeted flyby. the flyby in September was inbound over the unilluminated low albedo hemisphere, and so this is a really good opportunity to do radar imaging. And in particular, we got very good views of the bright dark boundary on the anti-Saturnian hemisphere, and so this is another opportunity to really see what the relationship is between the dark and bright terrain and give us more clues about what's going on and why the dark material is there and where it might be coming from. And of course, we also got really good equatorial ridge views because it was the pass had its closest approach over a very low latitude near the equator, and again on that anti-Saturnian boundary region. So what we're finding is that thermal segregation is very important, and John Spencer is going to talk about that next. And then we'll have imaging results from Tillman Dank, and John will then again talk about the Sears results. Roger Clark will talk about Vim's results, and then I'll come back and talk about UBIS results, and then we'll have Steve Ostro talking about the really interesting radar. So why don't we go to John Spencer now for page 5.
Okay, thanks, Amanda. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yep.
All right. I'm going to just say a little bit, sort of a theoretical introduction as to what thermal segregation is and why we think it's important on Iapetus, and explains quite a lot of what we see in the images and the other data that we got. So on slide number 6, that's entitled Ice Sublimation on Iapetus, all of Saturn's moons we think have ice on their surfaces. You're not sure about Titan, but that probably does too. And things are pretty cold out at Saturn's distance from the Sun, and so on most of the moons, the ice is really hard frozen, and it acts like a rock, really. There's not very much happens to it. But Iapetus is an exception. It's a surface can get pretty warm compared to the other moons for two reasons, really. One is that it's a very dark surface, which absorbs most incoming sunlight. Excuse me. And the other reason is that Iapetus rotates very slowly, and that means that the surface has a lot of time to heat up during the day, and so you get dark terrains on other moons like Phoebe, for example, that don't get nearly as warm as Iapetus because Phoebe rotates much faster and it just doesn't get as warm during the day. And so on Iapetus, you cross the critical threshold where ice becomes mobile. It can evaporate, or technically we say sublime, because that's the technical term for ice that turns from solid to a vapor without melting first, but it's evaporation. And once it evaporates, it can rise off the surface and fall down somewhere else and move around, and this can happen on local or global scales. So the next slide, which I guess runs slide number 7 now, that talks about local ice movement or thermal segregation, which is really a very simple process, and it's one I've been thinking about for a long time. And the figure here is from my dissertation from 1987. And it's really just, it's a kind of instability where if you have a dirty ice surface and there's any kind of temperature variation on the surface, that could be due to some areas being a little bit darker than others or some areas being a little shadier than others, any kind of discrepancy in surface temperatures, you're going to get this discrepancy in evaporation rates, because the warmer regions are going to evaporate faster. And as they evaporate, you're going to get the ice evaporating and the dirt gets left behind on the surface. And so the evaporation darkens the surface, makes it warmer, and that increases the evaporation. And in the same way, any region that is brighter than average is going to get more ice falling down on its surface than it can evaporate itself, and it's going to accumulate ice. So the cooler regions tend to get brighter and get cooler still, and it's a runaway process, and eventually you get to the point where the regions that were originally a little bit darker are now completely dark. They're completely covered in dirt, not ice at all, and they're very warm. And then the regions that were a little bit warmer, a little bit colder, now are covered in fresh ice and are much brighter and colder still. And So the surface just automatically sorts itself out into bright and dark terrain. And this was just a theoretical idea in 1987, but when we flew past Jupiter's moons with the Galileo spacecraft in the 1990s, this is now on the next slide, I guess we're on slide number 8 now, then we saw that indeed these surfaces had undergone what appeared to be thermal segregation. So this is a close-up picture of Callisto seen from the Galileo orbiter. And most of the surface is very dark and appears not to have any water ice. And it's presumably covered in at least a thin layer of dirt that's protecting the ice underneath from sublimation. And then scattered across the surface on the tops of hills, in this case, are bright regions where all the ice that's evaporated from the dark regions has condensed and it's concentrated there. So everything's either black or white and not much of anything in between. And as Tillman will show, this seems to have happened on Iapetus as well. But this is just local movement of ice, but this will happen on a global scale as well, particularly on Iapetus, where the gravity is relatively low and water molecules that evaporate off the surface can go hundreds of kilometers before they condense again. So ice can move around quite rapidly on the surface. And the next slide, slide number 9, shows a model that I produced a couple of years ago to explain the results from the first flyby of Iapetus that Amanda was talking about, where we notice that Iapetus is not a simple case of a bright hemisphere and a dark hemisphere. The arrows and the text have got a little out of alignment here, but the top image shows what would happen if Iapetus was simply moving through a cloud of dark material and the side that faced forward in its orbit would become darker and the opposite side would stay bright, and you'd get that simple two-tone appearance in that top right figure. But things aren't so simple on Iapetus. The actual Iapetus, the bright material extends over the poles, and the dark material extends around the equator. So instead of having two simple hemispheres, it's like the two... This is like almost like the seam in a tennis ball, where you have the bright stuff wrapping around the poles and the dark stuff wrapping around the equator. And this is something that can be explained by thermal ice migration. And after we came up with this model and after the last flyby, we got an email from Mendes, who was a researcher back in the 1970s, saying, "Hey, I thought of this back in 1974. And indeed, there was an abstract published back there that suggested that thermal sublimation of ice on Iapetus could be part of the explanation for its appearance. So this is not a new idea, but we've developed it in more detail. So the next slide shows how I tested this idea quantitatively. And so I had a simple model where I assume that Iapetus is covered in ice, but then you darken the leading side, the side that faces forward in its orbit, by infalling dark material. And so then the ice can evaporate and recondense elsewhere, and you track where all the molecules go. And in this model, I assumed that the evaporation shut off when just about a millimeter of ice had evaporated or sublimed. And this could be because you've exhausted the ice layer on the surface, or you've formed a thin layer of dirt on the surface that protects the ice underneath. It works either way. And so the next few slides, starting on slide number 11, just show how this model would work. There's a bunch of panels here. The main ones to pay attention to, though, are the top two, each of which is a map of Iapetus with latitude and longitude. And the one on the upper left shows the thickness of frost. This is at the beginning of the model where you have a uniform thickness of frost everywhere, so everything looks kind of gray. And then the upper right map shows the albedo, where we have a dark leading hemisphere centered at 90 degrees longitude and the bright trailing hemisphere centered at 270 degrees longitude. So this is the setup. Then the other plots simply are slices through the frost from pole to pole or along the equator to show the thickness of the frost as the model progresses. So slide number 12 shows that in a very short time, because this ice is dark and can evaporate pretty easily in only 60,000 years, you've started to burn off the dark ice from the leading side centered on 90 degrees longitude. And you've produced a bare patch there, which is just covered in dirt. And as you progress, line number 13 and 14 and 15, which gets up to 50 million years, you can see this dark area expanding. The ice is recondensing near the poles. It's making the poles brighter. But it's expanding more along the equator because that's where it's warmer than it is towards the poles. So you're getting this oval dark patch that is gradually growing. And by the time you get to 90 million years, or 89.92 in this exact simulation on slide number 16, you're starting to evaporate a little bit of ice from the equatorial region on the leading side as well. And when you compare this albedo pattern in the upper right to the actual map of Iapetus in the lower right, you see we've actually pretty accurately reproduced the distribution of the bright and dark terrain on Iapetus. So this was a clue even back before the latest flyby that indeed temperatures and the migration of ice around the surface was pretty important on Iapetus and controlled some of what was happening there. And you notice I don't show any images beyond the 89 million years. We ran the model further. And beyond that point, the model stops looking like Iapetus because most of the ice disappears from low latitudes on the trailing side as well, around 270 degrees longitude. And that has not happened on Iapetus. And I think that's what that's telling us is that the process that's happening is happening. Things are being renewed. More ice is being added to the system, maybe being dug up from underneath by impacts or something like that, to replenish the ice on about 100 million year time scale. So things reach a sort of equilibrium over that kind of time scale. So, but that's kind of arm wavy. We don't have an exact model of that. But run to this point, the model works very well. So that's what I showed. And the next slide, number 17, is just a conclusion from this part of the talk, saying that we think ice migration is important on Iapetus, both because we see local thermal segregation, as Tillman will show, and we, because of the shape of the light-dark boundary, is matched very well by these kind of models. And because of this thermal evaporation, one of the predictions from this model is that there is no ice at all in the dark terrain. It's just too warm. It's completely evaporated from those regions, and that's something we can test using. And so I'll come back in a little while and I'll talk about the temperature measurements we actually got and how they compare to this model, but that's it from me for now, and I guess Tillman is going to tell you about the images next.
Okay. Hey, now?
Yeah, we can hear you now, Tillman.
Continue, okay. Okay, good morning, and many thanks for joining us. My name is Tillmann Denk, and I'm working at the Freie University in Berlin in Germany. And one of my major tasks in the past was imaging observation planning of the recent Iapetus flyby. And with the data in hand now, I have to find out what it all means, what we can see there. And this is still at the beginning, but I will tell you a little bit about the progress that we have done so far. Let's go to view graph 20 now, tidal trailing side of Iapetus. It shows a 15-panel mosaic of the trailing side of Iapetus. The big basin in the south that you can see there is about 480 kilometers in diameter, and this is almost the size of the moon Enceladus. Big basins are quite common on Iapetus. In this case here, on the trailing side, a very unusual property is in addition that an older basin of similar size has been partly destroyed by a later impact. Then immediately west of these two basins, there's an area with an unusual hummocky texture. It might be possible that this was formed by the impact itself. Then when going further north towards the terminator, we can see some tectonic structure. Several linear features might be related to large impacts, but this has to be studied in detail before we can say something conclusive here. In the right or eastern part of the image, the dark bright transition terrain is visible very clearly. We knew from previous low-resolution data that this is a really complex area, but in the new images, it looks even more complicated than we thought it is. Near the equator, we see lots of dark floor craters, and interestingly, these can be detected all around the Iapetus globe at low latitudes, so there is this effect that John has just described that his model does not describe very well, is at least in some parts be visible. To the very east, the ridge can be seen in the dark terrain while rising behind the horizon, and the bright spots just left of the ridge are mountains with bright areas that have already been recognized in Voyager data. So let's go to the next view graph. This is number 21. The equatorial ridge, as seen in New Year's Eve 2005 data, this to the right, and in the most recent high phase images. The letter A that you can see in both insets indicates an identical location, and you can also see this in the next view graph, 22. Here are three views from the wide-angle camera taken in the 40 minutes before closest approach. The letters indicate similar areas in the pictures, and the resolution is about 300 meters per pixel in the very left frame and about 100 meters in the right one. North is to the right for all three, and west is up here. The ridge morphology changes with longitude. Further to the east, this is the left image. Between the letters A and B, the roof of the ridge looks very flat, while it changes into a sharp ring just west of the position B, or a little bit up of the letter B. It also changes into isolated mountains there, instead of a continuous ridge as it is before. Two of them appear quite tall, of these isolated mountains, then only a few rather flat ones follow, up to the large mountain visible at the horizon of the middle image. Here, the top rim looks again different. Its shape appears now more rounded. Then view graph 23. This should be a movie. Unfortunately, it's not one in the PDF, so we have to skip that. Let's go to 24. This view graph shows this area again, but from the other direction. West is now towards bottom, and east is up. The red arrow shows the mountain labeled C in the earlier view graph, and the continuous ridge is now visible at the horizon, and the mountain with the bright western flanks in the center of the image is the one that was visible at the limb in the middle image in the view graph 22nd. So next view graph 25. This is the easternmost of a group of mountains that we have already recognized in Voyager 2 data. The top right full globe image is the Voyager image that shows the mountains at the limb, and the arrows show the viewing directions of the new Cassini images. The blue one, the blue arrow, shows the westward view at a high phase angle, that's the right image. The yellow arrow shows a low phase, more nadir looking view, that's the image at left. From the Voyager images, we believed that the mountains are fully bright, but Cassini data show now that only the western flanks have bright patches, and the major part of the surface of the mountains, of these mountains that were detected in the Voyager data, are still dark. Next view graph, 26. How does the equatorial ridge proceed on the trailing side in the western direction? This was one of the main questions for the flyby, and we knew that a few bright mountains are located near the center of the anti-Saturn point. You can see the circle, and the right three circles were correlated to mountains that we have known that exist. And with the Cassini data now, especially with stereo data, this means with data of the same terrain taken from different viewing directions to allow triangulation and the production of digital terrain models. With such data, we can now see that these isolated mountains extend at least towards 245 degrees western longitude, so there are at least four more such mountains. The red cross shows the center of the trailing side. This is the point of the surface located exactly opposite to the direction of motion of Iapetus. And there's still a small area about 300 kilometers wide where we do not know so far if the ridge or mountains extend in this area, because we do not have stereo data for this area. Further to the west, we come closer to the terminator, and there's no indication of unusual equatorial mountains in this region. Next one, 27. This absence of a ridge can be traced over about 70 degrees around Iapetus circumference. The appearance of the ridge around the whole globe shows that this view graph, the number 27, here you can see where we have an equatorial ridge on Iapetus and where it is missing. The green bars show that the ridge, or at least isolated mountains, are there. The red bar shows absence of ridge or mountains. There are areas like between about 340 degrees west and 50 degrees west where one can argue that an ancient ridge might have been destroyed by a giant impact, but at other areas like between 270 and 330 degrees west in particular, there's no obvious large impact structure visible, and so this means that our tentative answer of the question, did the ridge ever span fully around Iapetus globe, is we don't know yet. But maybe we can find out. Then the next view graph is 28. Dark and bright. This is also an important topic on Iapetus, and the new images show almost no gray areas, only either dark or bright areas. This is suggestive that the process that creates the dark blanket must be very efficient in removing or covering the bright ice, and for me this is one of the major reasons why I believe that John Spencer's model with the thermal segregation is really an important one for the surface of Iapetus. Next one, 29. The equatorward facing slopes are dark, at least at low and mid latitudes, and wherever you look in this image, most of the dark terrain is correlated to slopes that are facing to the left, and to the left is to the equator in this case. It is also very interesting that the amount of dark terrain is reduced to further south, the further south we go. This is another indicator that a thermal effect plays a significant role on the surface of Iapetus. So the closer to the pole we are, the colder it is, and the less dark material is visible on the surface. Then the next number, 30. As mentioned before, hints for this behavior of poleward bright or equatorward dark slopes were already obtained in data of the 2004 non-targeted flyby. And there you can also see some striation in the upper image, but this is actually an illusion. That is not really a true surface property. This is the illumination effect that indicates that there is maybe the material coming from an area closer to the equator, but actually this is the illumination. You can always see the dark shadow, then the bright crater floor, and then the brownish crater rim pattern. And this points exactly to the sun, so we have always the same brightness pattern here in the craters, and this is indicative also that it's always the equatorward facing slopes that are dark, and in the bottom picture you can see that the bright rims are facing to the pole. Then the next one is 31. Bright spots in the dark terrain. This is another topic that we want to explore with the imaging data. What we searched for them already in the 2004 data, where we had about 800 meters per pixel spatial resolution, and we could not see any obvious bright ejecta in the dark terrain. So this means we couldn't find any bright hole down to about half a kilometer in size. The inset shows about 4 kilometer spatial resolution, and there you can also see that at the equatorial area there's no dark bright spots in the dark terrain, and this is only visible at higher latitudes, but there again it is the poleward facing slopes of craters that show this property. Then next, the view graph 32. In the data from the recent flyby, this changed. With spatial resolutions down to about 10 meters per pixel, we could see several bright spots and many bright crater rims, what indicates that the darkening process is ongoing today. The bright ejecta seen here is the most prominent that we have found. The corresponding crater is about 60 meters in diameter. Since a 60-meter sized crater is less than 10 meters deep, we can infer from these images that the dark layer should be no more than a couple of meters thick. Next one, 33. Now I will switch to the global brightness dichotomy question. This list shows my pre-Cassini view of the literature, and I will not go through this in detail, this would take too much time, but most attendants received the second group, which assumes that a process bringing in material from outside causes an alteration of the surface, but none of these ideas that are listed here received fully acceptance. Next one, 34. This view graph summarizes our current view following the most recent flyby, and it contains properties and processes more or less unique to Iapetus, and their combination leads to the unique brightness dichotomy. We have first a synchronous rotation, which gives a leading and a trailing side. This is not uncommon for satellites, but for Iapetus it plays a significant role for the explanation of this brightness dichotomy. Then second, we have a source of exogenic material that is influencing the leading side, but not really the trailing side. That's possible due to the synchronous rotation. And what kind of source this is another question that is not directly related to Iapetus, but we can assume that there is one, and micrometeorites from the interplanetary space, or my preferred version is that the outer moons of Saturn are losing material, and the retrograde moons, the material from the retrograde moons is spiraling in and hitting Iapetus on the leading side. These are two candidates. Then third, the orbit of Iapetus is far out, and this is important because it means that there is no big obstacle like Titan that prevents exogenic material to reach the surface. This is also the case for Hyperion, but not for the other regular moons of Saturn, like Rhea, for instance. If material from outside is spiraling in, then Titan would sweep up everything before it can reach Rhea or Dione or all the other inner moons. The next view graph, 35, this should be an animation that was in... Unfortunately, it's not one in the PDF, it was only one in the PowerPoint file.
People can go back and access the PowerPoint, you know, later on, and then they can see the animation.
Okay, but that's not that bad. It shows just different brightness enhancements of the dark and bright terrain, and how the color of the dark and the bright terrain is correlated to the location on the surface. And it appears that the 180 degrees and the 0 degrees meridians, these are those that separate the leading and the trailing side of Iapetus, that these are also a separator for the color. The leading side has a redder and slightly darker color throughout the poles, from poles to the equator down to the other pole, while the trailing side color is a little bit more greenish, whatever this means in detail. And that was detected in the data from the imaging system in the last few years, and that's very interesting because it provides a link between two theories that will probably explain the brightness dichotomy. Then the next one, the continuation of the last one, the fourth point, the very slow rotation of Iapetus. This is also key because it allows parts of the surface to get a temperature that is higher than anywhere else in the Saturnian system, and as John already explained, the thermal segregation process can only act on Iapetus, or is only acting in a global way on Iapetus, and one reason is because it rotates so slow, and this allows the sun to stay on the surface for a very long time, over about 40 days almost, and this allows the temperature to go unusually high. So it's still very low for our sensing, but for the Saturnian system it's very high temperatures. And then the fifth point, the dark blanket is very thin. This is inferred from the imaging data from the Sprite Greater rays, for instance, and also from radar data that Steve Ostro will say anything about in one of the next presentations. And then finally, the thermal segregation as an acting process is proposed. And when you go to the next view graph, then you can see the story that we want to propose, how the brightness dichotomy on Iapetus is formed. There is some dust from outer satellites. This was proposed earlier by Soter in 1974 and then from Bonnie Borati in 2002. She was extending the idea that Phoebe is the delivery body to the other outer satellites, what makes more sense because the color of Phoebe doesn't really match, although Roger Clark will argue why this might not be a problem. And then this satellite dust does not cause the brightness dichotomy as was proposed earlier, but it causes the color dichotomy that was detected in the ISS data. And this color dichotomy, this is triggering, so to speak, a asymmetry between the leading and the trailing side that the model by John Spencer is requiring for the thermal redistribution, so that the thermal segregation is acting in a very excessive way on the leading side, but only on a, let's say, minor way, especially near the equator at the bottoms of the craters and especially on the slopes that are facing to the equator on the trailing side. And the REF-49 data from ISS and CIRS in particular nicely support this scenario. Then the last few graphs show pictures of Saturn. We also made some images where I was thinking about the planetarium directors that might like to show on their cupolas how Saturn might look from Iapetus, and therefore we took about 34 hours before the flyby this image of Saturn, and also in the next view graph you can see an image of Iapetus that was taken at the same time, and since the spacecraft was approaching over the unlit hemisphere, Iapetus is still visible as a crescent by Saturn, and the moons are visible as almost full globes. Okay, and there is still some information on locations where you can find the data, of course, in the pictures on the website of the Cassini imaging team in cyclops.org, but we at the Free University of Berlin, I also want to advertise our website a little bit. We also compiled all the raw images of Iapetus, and we also have a site that shows the planning in detail. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Tillman. Were there any questions? Because Tillman's going to have to go after his talk here. Okay, well, with that, we'll go on to Dr. Roger Clark. Roger, have you joined us?
Yes.
Wonderful. Take it away.
Okay. Let's see. Slide 41 is the title slide. We can rapidly move on to slide 42, which tells a little bit about the VIMS instrument, a visual and infrared mapping spectrometer. The VIMS is an imaging system. All the images on this slide are taken with the VIMS. And the difference between it and a standard camera is we're spatial resolution challenged, so we only have 64 by 64 pixels, so we have to take lots of frames and mosaic them together to build up a big image. But our advantage is in every pixel in every image that we take, we get 352 wavelengths, and we get those all at the same time. Whereas with like the ISS camera, which has great spatial resolution, they have to move filters into place to get multiple wavelengths. So it's a trade between spatial and spectral. And spectral allows us to get compositional information, which you'll see. The spatial resolution of VIMS is similar to what you can see with your eye if you're slightly myopic, like 20/30 vision. So the images that you see, if you were standing on the spacecraft, would from VIMS, the images you would see would be similar to what you could see if you were standing there, you know, like in a spacesuit, of course. Okay, let's go to the next slide, and slide 43. And it shows mosaics of our Iapetus data from the REV-49 flyby in three different wavelengths. And these are all in the infrared, and I'll explain a little bit the wavelengths on the next slide when I show a spectrum. But So your eye sees about from 0.4 to 0.7 microns in wavelength. So these wavelengths, 1.8 microns, are way beyond what your eye can see and beyond what color infrared film can see also. So the 1.8 micron reflectance shows a view very similar to visible, and there's an ISS frame, IAPTIS, there on the left to show for comparison. And the dark material is dark, and the bright material, the icy regions, are bright at 1.8 microns. But as we move further into the infrared, into the closer to the 3 micron region, so there's a 2.65 micron reflectance, there the ice is getting darker and the dark material is getting brighter. And then as you move even further to the infrared, you see in the lower left frame at 5 microns, the so-called dark material is actually bright and the ice is very dark. In fact, in the 4 to 5 micron region, ice in general is darker than charcoal. So it's really quite dark. And then the bright material here is more a light gray in color, if you could see at those wavelengths. And then in the lower right is just a color composite of that, so you can see the relationships going on as a function of reflectance. So if you had infrared eyes, you could see something like this in terms of color. Let's go to the next slide, slide 44. So this is a typical spectra that we see from the VIMS. And again, your eye sees over there just very leftmost portion of the plot from 0.4 to 0.7 microns approximately, basically where you see that hump in the blue spectrum, which is called the Rayleigh scattering peak. And this Rayleigh scattering peak is quite important, and I'll get back to it in a minute. First, looking at the blue spectrum at 1.5 and 2 microns, there are two big, deep absorption bands due to water, H2O ice. And then we go into a big 3 micron ice band, and then out beyond 4 microns, you can see how dark the ice is. It's way down there just on the very bottom, reflecting only a couple of percent reflectance. And charcoal, like from a grill, is maybe 4 or 5% reflectance. So this is quite a bit darker than charcoal. Also seen there is CO2 at 4.25 microns. And we're seeing CO2 throughout the Saturn system, mainly in the dark material, but it may be in the ice also. We also see CO2 in the Jupiter system, so there may be a connection here, and we're trying to work on that. Working from the long wavelength shorter, the next exciting thing there is CH. We see a tiny trace hint of some CH bonds. These are organic molecules. And we have a paper in press on that, and I'll give the reference to that in a sec. Then a little bit shorter is NH3 with a question mark. The reason why we have a question mark there is that right at that wavelength, our instrument has a filter gap between order sorting filters from the grating, and that causes some funny effects sometimes. So we have a little bit of uncertainty in our calibration. However, as the IAPTIS data has come in, and we had a team meeting last week, I think I convinced most people on our team that this is a real feature, and we're mapping a real feature on the surface. And that's a big advantage to an imaging spectrometer, is that we can see what are artifacts and what are real by not just the shape of the spectrum, but that we're mapping real things on the surface. And this ammonia band maps in the dark material all over IAPTIS. Then moving shorter, well, the big broad thing there at 3 microns is due to a combination of things. There can be some ice in there. There can be some bound water. And this is the region where in water the OH stretch fundamental occurs. The O and the H chemical bond is stretching at that wavelength. And NH, ammonia, stretches in that region too. So there could be ammonia bound to minerals that contributes to this band. And because it's all smushed together into one big broad envelope there, we can't separate them at this time. At shorter wavelengths, we see a lot of little small weak features there around 2 to 2.5 microns, and we're working on what exactly those are caused by. Typically, they're hydrogen-related, either in like OH or NH bonds, and we see these kind of things in minerals a lot. So they're not unusual, but until we know the specific wavelengths or can identify a specific compound to them, we can't say much more. But once we can, it might tell us something specific about the chemistry going on. What we can say is it's out of this world, because we don't have anything like this in our databases at the moment. So then going back to the visible part of the spectrum, where the Rayleigh scattering peak is, this is interesting because Rayleigh scattering in surfaces was not recognized prior to 2007. And so it's a relatively new discovery of the effect, and it has some interesting implications for the Saturn system. And one is that you only need a fraction of a weight percent up to maybe a couple of weight percent of very fine particles distributed uniformly and widely throughout the ice, and you need that small amount. If you get too much, then the particles get too close together on average and the Rayleigh effect goes away. So Rayleigh scattering occurs when the particles that are causing the scattering are much less than the wavelength of light. And since we're working with half micron wavelengths here, they have to be much smaller than half a wavelength, or half a micron in wavelength. So, and the Earth's sky is blue because of scattering off of molecules. So typically Rayleigh scattering is caused by particles much, much smaller than the wavelength, in this case in the Earth's atmosphere, molecular sized particles. But you get the effect to some degree as you approach the wavelength, and then above the wavelength, then the effect will go away. So this Rayleigh peak tells us that we have very fine particles mixed into the surface layer of the ice. But we're seeing this variable throughout the surface of Iapetus, and variable amounts on other objects as well. All the satellites we're seeing it, including some in Saturn's rings, all the way out to Phoebe. We see it nicely on Dione. We see it nicely on some of the small moons like Epimetheus. So it's fairly common in the Saturn system. And what this is telling us is there's this very fine-grained dust coming in and coating the surfaces of all of these objects, and that's telling us it's external to these bodies. Now, there still could be some material, that some dark material that is endogenic to the bodies, but predominantly what we're seeing optically has to be the exogenic. Back to those 2-micron features, we're seeing those throughout the Saturn system on other bodies also. We see these strongly on Phoebe, and we see them on Dione. We see it in the F ring. So the same composition that's causing this stuff, even though we don't know the exact composition, because the absorption bands are the same, we know the composition is the same. So we have the same composition, we have the same Rayleigh scattering effect going on throughout the Saturn system, implying that this dust is coming in and coating all these objects. So the question is, where is it coming from? Well, let's go on just a little bit here and go to slide 45. This just shows a blow-up of the 3-micron regions and shows the very weak absorption bands we're seeing for the organic compounds, trace amounts, fractions of a percent. And these kind of compounds do exist in like comets and in the interstellar medium, so these are not unusual molecules by any means, but it's at least chemically interesting that they're there. And PAHs stand for polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. Next slide. Oh, and that's that PAH is in a Cruikshank et al. Icarus paper, which I think is online now. Okay, so going to slide 46, shows a map of the different compounds that we're seeing. The CO2, which you can see is mapped in red in the color composite image, and that's predominantly in the dark regions. The bright areas correlate with the green H2O ice, and that's pretty obvious, I think. Bright, it's icy, and fairly clean ice. And then the blue is showing the Rayleigh scattering strength, and what this image shows is that as you move away from the equator, the ice is getting cleaner. And this, what this means is water molecules are being driven from the equator toward the poles, so that we're getting cleaner ice. So it's covering up some of these fine dark grains, and that supports John Spencer's segregation model. Let's go on to the next slide. This just shows our high-resolution view of the Viapetus in the dark to light transition zone, so you can see the interplay between the CO2-containing dark material and the bright icy material. And then along the equator there, that's a horizontal band, you see the bright white mountains sticking up, and those are more pure ice. Let's go to the next slide, and this shows some of the effects that we're seeing we don't fully understand, and that is this 2-micron triplet occurs in the dark material, and then as you move toward the bright material, a little bit of ice gets mixed in with the dark material. So the further away from this transition zone, the less ice there is. I think UVIS will show that they're seeing ice kind of everywhere, and that may be in our big 3-micron band that we see everywhere. Even the dark material has this 3-micron band, and so yes, there could be ice still in the darkest areas. And as we get closer to the brightest areas, we get the strongest water signature, and as this map shows, the ice bands are asymmetric, and they're asymmetric in a way that we don't yet understand. They're not like laboratory ice that we produce here in the lab. And we're seeing this asymmetry throughout the Saturn system. And it's also seen in a couple of other places where there are good spectra, like the Uranian satellites have this asymmetric absorption also. So it's telling us something we don't yet understand, but we're working on that problem. Something's happening to the ice structure is what it's telling us. Let's go to the next slide, which shows the CO2. The CO2 occurs throughout the Saturn system. Wherever we see the dark material, we get the strongest signature of CO2. And the CO2 band is moving around. And we understand in principle why, but we can't say specifically why yet. The CO2 is trapped, and it's saying it's trapped in different things for it to move around. This is pretty common on the Earth. Many minerals have CO2 trapped in them, and depending on the bonding of the mineral, it'll move the band around. So this is actually telling us that there is some compositional variation, that the CO2 is being trapped into different things, and we're working on trying to understand what those are right now. Let's go to the next slide, and this shows the ammonia band and how it's just a trace, less than a weight percent of ammonia condensed on different compounds in the laboratory reproduce the shape of the absorption band that we're seeing strongly. We see it on Phoebe, we see it on Dione, we see it on Iapetus. We do not see it in the effering, which is interesting. And we've only gotten good, clean, or relatively clean signatures of dark material on those three objects, Phoebe, Dione, and Iapetus, and they all have the same composition. And then the next slide, slide 51, shows the distributions that we're finding for the CO2, the ammonia, and the water ice. Some of the trends that we're seeing, which we're trying to model now, and that is the CO2 is strongest at the transition zone, and as you move further into the dark regions, the CO2 decreases a lot. And opposing that, as you move further into the dark regions, the ammonia tends to increase. So we're trying to figure out what that means and what that may mean for John's sublimation model. Okay, next slide, slide 52 is conclusions. So this is what VIMS has detected and what we understand so far. So we have beautiful signatures of water ice and can map the water ice. We have the strongest signatures of CO2 that we've seen anywhere in the Saturn system. We see variable positions of the CO2, showing that there is compositional variability that we're trying to understand. We have trace amounts of organics. We have trace amounts of ammonia. I think that probably has become a little stronger in the last week as we've understood our instruments, and this mapping of Iapetus has helped us to understand that. And I think the band is becoming more accepted. We have several unknowns for which we don't have any match to any compounds in our terrestrial spectral databases. So we're trying to synthesize compounds and try and to understand what these absorptions are. And that's one of the nice things about spectroscopy. It can point us in the direction and get us close so that with a little chemistry work in the lab, hopefully we can find out the exact answer. But sometimes it takes years to do that. This Rayleigh scattering effect I've explained pretty well. The particles must be very small, and both in diameter and abundance on the surfaces. So all of these surfaces where there's ice, there's very pure ice, but not completely pure. It's not as pure as freshly fallen snow on the Earth, for example. All of these things taken together, we see these same compositions throughout the Saturn system, the Rayleigh scattering effect. It's all implying that there's dust coming in from external source to these satellites, and that may mean that it's external to the Saturn system, or where, if it's not external to the Saturn system, where might it be generated? And there's no clear evidence that it's generated on all of the major moons. Could it be coming from one of the smaller outer moons? And with that, I'll stop.
Okay. Do we have any questions right now before we go on to John? Okay. Let's go ahead and go on to the next presentation. John, go ahead.
Okay. This will be fairly quick because I've already kind of given you the bottom line, but I will describe now the first look at the SEERS observations. That's the thermal infrared observations of IAPSIS that we got on the September flyby. So this is the whole SEERS team here. And first, just a quick primer on blackbody radiation and how this allows us to measure the temperature of something from a distance. Basically anything that is warmer than absolute zero is emitting heat radiation. And the wavelength and the intensity of the radiation is characteristic of the temperature. And so here you have a picture of lava coming out of a fracture on a lava flow. And when it's very hot, it's emitting yellow light and red light and a lot of infrared light as well, which you don't see in the photo, of course. But as it cools, you only get the red light and the infrared light. And as it's even cooler, you don't see any light at all. The lava looks black, but if you put your hand up to it, your hand can certainly feel the infrared heat radiation coming off that lava. And you could still, if you had infrared-sensitive eyes, measure that heat and measure the temperature. So by looking in infrared light, particularly for cool objects, we can measure their temperatures. And at the very low temperatures that we get in the Saturn system, the wavelength where the heat radiation comes off is very long wavelengths. It's usually almost always too long a wavelength for Roger Clark's VIMS instrument to detect. And so we have another instrument on Cassini called the SEERS instrument, which detects the longer wavelength infrared light and can detect the heat radiation. So the next slide shows a picture of the SEERS instrument and just describes briefly what it does. So we're sensitive to wavelengths between 7 microns and 300 microns, and remember, VIMS is from 1 to 5 microns. So these very long wavelengths, we can detect the heat radiation from the cold objects in the Saturn system. And SEERS obtains spectra, not just a measurement of the total amount of heat radiation, which is very useful for Saturn and Titan to measure their compositions, but for solid objects in the Saturn system, like Saturn's rings and the moons, we get some temperature information, though, you know, maybe we'll get some compositional information at some point, but it's a lot more tricky to do that. So mostly we're looking at temperatures. The next slide recaps our previous flyby of IAPSIS with and the observations we got with the SEERS instrument. This is the New Year 2005 flyby. So there, with the best observations we got, had a spatial resolution of about 35 kilometers. That's the smallest things we could see. And we saw temperatures up to 130 Kelvin, or which is a whopping minus 225 Fahrenheit. So that's pretty warm for Saturn, and that's what got us thinking about water migration on the surface of IAPSIS. But we didn't get a good look at the night side, and really most of our dayside data, apart from a little bit near the poles, was of the dark terrain. So it was a pretty limited look So we're very anxious to get the data from the flyby last September, where we could look both at the night sky temperatures and temperatures on both bright and dark terrain during the day. So the next slide shows a nighttime temperature map that we obtained in the September flyby. And here we got a really nice view of the night sky. The temperature map in the lower right is showing temperatures measured by our long wavelength part of our instrument, and this is at wavelengths between 20 and 200 microns. And temperatures are really pretty uniform on the night side. Here it's between 50 and 55 Kelvin, which is pretty cold, but pretty uniform. And as the upper image shows, this superimposes the temperature color information on the albedo data from the imaging camera and shows that we're mostly looking at the dark side here at night. And so this was 130 Kelvin during the day. It's only 55 Kelvin at night, so it's cooling off very dramatically at night. And that means the surface has to be very fluffy. It's really not very good at retaining heat at all. And in fact, the amount of fluffiness, which we measure by something called the thermal inertia, is similar to the other Saturnian moons, even though this is a rather unusual surface. It has about that same kind of texture, and it's a very poor conductor of heat. We do see some interesting anomalies on top of that. The green arrow points to a region over on the right side, which is distinctly warmer than its surroundings. And this seems to be a region that's better at maintaining heat through the night, and it's maybe a little bit less fluffy than its surroundings, but who knows what's going on there. But the really high-resolution data we got was of the day side and of the bright-dark boundary, and the next slide shows a high-res noontime scan across the region where the bright and the dark terrain are intermingled around midday. And now our resolution is only 8 kilometers. And we're seeing very large variations in temperature in this scan. The red rectangle in the right-hand panel shows where this scan is on the visible wavelength images. And you can see, if you look between those two, a very good correspondence between the dark terrain and the warm temperatures, and the bright terrain and the cold temperatures. So every dark spot on the images turns into a warm spot in the SEERS infrared scan. And here we get peak temperatures a little bit cooler, 128 Kelvin, compared to what we saw in the middle of the dark terrain on our flyby 2 years ago. But in the bright terrain, the temperatures were only getting up to about 113 Kelvin. So that's a pretty significant difference. The next slide shows a blow-up of the image and shows the size of our field of view where we're measuring that 128 Kelvin. You see it's almost completely, it is really completely on the dark terrain, so we're getting a pure measurement of the dark terrain temperature. And then similarly, our coldest temperature is purely on the bright terrain. So we're, thanks to the thermal segregation that sorts these things out into these very large patches of bright and dark, we can completely resolve the temperatures of the two components. And that's nice because that allows us to calculate the rate at which ice should be subliming or evaporating from these surfaces, because that does depend on the temperature. And so from the bright terrain at 113 degrees Kelvin, if you leave ice at that temperature or at that maximum daytime temperature on the surface for a billion years, you'll only lose 10 centimeters, just 2.5 inches of ice from the... as 4 inches, sorry. Anyway, not very much ice in that much time. And in a billion years, you'll be able to mix the ice back in or dig up more ice from the interior just by impacts on the surface. So that's a pretty insignificant rate of evaporation. But on the dark terrain, you'd lose 60 feet in a billion years. And that's more than you could really put back by any other process. And so you're going to lose ice from the dark material. It's really not stable there. And so this is consistent with the thermal segregation that we see that I talked about earlier, the bright pole-facing slopes and the dark equator-facing slopes that Tillman talked about, and the overall shape of the light-dark boundary being controlled by this evaporation of the water ice. And so just to conclude this, we've got nice direct measurements of the bright and dark terrain temperatures. And in the bright terrain, the ice is pretty stable. In the dark terrain, it's highly unstable, and we think that explains a lot of what we see. And that's it from Sears.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you very much, John. Before we go on to Amanda, I just wanted to remind everyone that regardless of the capabilities of your phone, if you press *6, you'll be muted. It sounds like there's somebody out there who has a muffled, and if you wanted to press *6, you would be muted. With that, we'll go on to Amanda.
Okay, great. So I'll start on slide 62 and talk about UVIS results from the IAPETUS flyby. On slide 63, we describe the briefly describe the ultraviolet imaging spectrograph. It's an imaging spectrometer. It has a two-dimensional detector, so there's 64 spatial pixels in one direction, and then the spectral dimension is in the other direction. And so at any time, we're getting at 1024 wavelengths, or a maximum of 1024 wavelengths. And then we can just scan the slit by slewing the spacecraft to make images. The far ultraviolet channel covers the wavelength range of about 110 to about 190 nanometers, and there are other spectral channels incorporated in the UVIS instrument, but I won't be focusing on those here in this presentation. So again, the IAPETUS observations that UVIS did during the September flyby included a stellar occultation, which I won't talk about too much, but we did do a stellar occultation where we watched a star pass behind the limb of IAPETUS to look for an attenuation of the starlight by any atmospheric gases that might be present, and we did not see any significant attenuation. We'll be using those results to place upper limits on any gases around IAPETUS, but we don't see anything very significant. So most of our work is focusing on surface reflectance measurements, which we can use to map out water ice and also non-ice species, and thereby sort of study the thermal segregation that we think is happening on IAPETUS that we've been talking about. So on the next slide, slide 64, is a plot that shows you what water ice looks like spectrally in the far ultraviolet. And this is showing you that it has a very strong, very significant absorption feature, longward of about 165 nanometers or 1600 angstroms. That water ice is very bright. And even longward of this, then it continues being bright through the near UV and through the visible. But shortward of about 1650 angstroms, water ice is very, very dark. And the wavelength of the absorption feature is generally dependent on the grain size that is present. So we can map out this absorption feature across the surface, and for any region that we look at, we can sort of determine the strength of this absorption band and use that to tell us about how much water ice is present. Now, on the next slide, slide 65, we zoom in on that water ice absorption feature shown here now in red and compare it with some other, the reflectance spectra of other sort of candidate species, carbon and tholins, for instance, to show you how they look in comparison and to show you that at, again, the longer FUV wavelengths, of course, water ice is much brighter. But at the shorter wavelengths, the water ice is so dark that these non-ice kind of primitive type materials are actually brighter than water ice. So again, we can use this information to map out different species. The next slide shows you one of the results that we obtained just to sort of highlight this spectral reversal of water ice and non-water ice stuff from the December 2004 or January 2005 flyby. Because water ice gets so dark at the shorter wavelengths and most non-water ice materials are brighter, we do see the spectral reversal. And this is shown by comparing these three images at the bottom where the ISS visible wavelength image is shown over on the right And then the Lyman Alpha image at short FUV wavelengths is shown in the middle, and this shows you that the bright pole is actually darker than the lower latitudes on the on that leading hemisphere there that are visibly dark. So there's a spectral reversal that we see, which is just kind of an interesting thing. Now, on slide 67, I'm showing you one of the images that we obtained on this recent flyby, and you can see that the spectral coverage, spectral resolution is greatly increased from that map that we obtained on the previous flyby. And here, this is a scan that we did of the boundary region, the light-dark boundary region on the anti-Saturnian hemisphere. And at this resolution, we can detect those bright Voyager mountains that are shown. You can kind of pick them out in this red and blue plot here at the top that show up as blue, which tells us that they're relatively high in water ice. And generally, we were finding that water ice concentration is going to be pretty well correlated with the bright areas, as Roger also mentioned from his results, too, from VIMS. But we can also even detect kind of vaguely this that very big crater within the bright terrain down towards the lower left. And we can use these types of maps along with higher resolution spectral information to try to understand how water ice content is varying across the surface and how the spectrum of the non-water ice stuff is varying too. Let's see, and then I also wanted to mention here that in this image here, it's a three-color composite, so the bluish-reddish or bluish-greenish tells you about basically reflected solar, which is brighter or brighter when there's a lot of water ice, and the red is the Lyman alpha wavelengths, and that's at the shorter wavelengths. And the sky is bright at Lyman alpha because of the interplanetary hydrogen and the Saturn system hydrogen too. But interestingly, also that the dark terrain on Iapetus is relatively bright at Lyman alpha because of that spectral reversal again. And so actually, it turns out that if you were a alien with UV vision or whatever flying around Iapetus, you might have to be careful not to crash into that dark material at the limb there, because you can't even see the limb. Okay, on the next slide, though, we pull out from that three-color composite. We just look at the longer wavelengths to try to get at a water ice map just by doing a simple correction for incidence angle right now, solar incidence. And again, we can see that the bright Voyager mountains seem to be relatively high in water ice, and generally, again, we see a pretty good correlation with bright material being being greater, richer in pure water ice. So on the next slide, slide 69, this is where we're starting to pull out UV spectra of particular regions on the surface to look for color variations and to look for water ice variations, either within the bright terrains or within the low albedo terrains, to look at volatile migration and to look at the distribution of the non-ice stuff. And so some of the dark regions that we've looked at here are labeled with red boxes, numbered by 1, 2, 3. The larger box number 1 was an area that we got a good spectrum of in the last flyby in December of 04, and then 2 and 3 are just some almost randomly picked regions just to compare with. 1, and
Amanda, is the width or height of that box, is that your slit height or length?
Is that no, actually.
Oh, okay.
What did we do here? No, the slit in 1, and remember, the slit is long and skinny.
Right.
So it wouldn't be square anyway. It could be if we did a scan.
Yeah, I was thinking scan.
But from 1, from that earlier flyby, the slit was bigger, and so we just took the few central pixels, pulled them out to get a spectrum of this area here.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying then.
And in 2 and 3, of course, we were much closer, and so the
spectral or the spatial resolution was a lot better, but still, I think that the I can't remember off the top of my head exactly like relatively how big the slit was, but I think we pulled out the central several rows to isolate different types of terrains.
Okay, thanks.
But before I go on, actually, we also then compare like a relatively bright, probably relatively icy rich region from the north pole of the leading hemisphere up in 5, and then another relatively bright area down here in 4, more in the boundary region. And on slide 70, we're ratioing region 4 to region 5, and we see the signature that I showed you before of water ice. And this tells us that that bright area in region 4 is probably richer in water ice than the bright area in region 5 in that north polar terrain. But it also tells us, because at the shorter wavelengths we can see kind of a reddish slope, very slight, but it isn't as flat as we would expect it to be if the difference were only due to the amount of water ice present, that in that boundary area there might be some other stuff mixed in that is slightly reddish in color. Okay, and then next slide is the same one I already showed you, but now we're going to compare some of the low albedo regions, the visibly low albedo regions, and I think we're going to compare 1 and 2. So this is 1 is important because it's at the apex of the leading hemisphere. And so if there is stuff coming in from an exogenic source, this is where we'd expect the flux to be highest, I'll leave it at that. And so we're looking for color variations, if they exist, between 1 and 2, and that'll tell us, again, about any mixing of material, maybe endogenic material that has come up from below and been gardened, and also the amount of volatiles that are present. So on page 72, we've ratioed the region 1, the apex region, to region 2. This is the FUV ratio, and you can see that it is not flat. And this tells us that region 1 has that they're probably compositionally different. And the way that we're interpreting this right now is that 1 is richer in some sort of absorbing material than 2, and it looks like it could have a very broad absorption feature in the FUV region. In slide 73, this is a reminder, okay, we don't have very many lab spectra of candidate species in this wavelength range, because it's kind of difficult to work in the lab and not that many people have made measurements, but we can use what we have and compare on page 74 the spectrum of an ice tholen to our absorption feature that we think we're measuring, and we see that we don't really get a very good fit, especially at the longer wavelengths. But then on slide 75, we compare with carbon, and it's a little bit better. It's pretty hard to say with such a broad band and with not very distinctive absorption features in the FUV that, you know, this is a sure fit or anything, but it's consistent with a story of carbonaceous material maybe coming in and maybe being a little bit more concentrated at that apex region. Slide 76 shows some UVIS results from the earlier flyby, where we were able to get latitudinal information within that apex region of the dark leading hemisphere and look at the water ice band and show that it becomes stronger as you go away from the equator, and that it is present weakly, though, at the lowest latitudes. So we're sensing water ice mixed in with the dark material, as shown by that blue spectrum, which does show a weak water ice feature. But these results here are consistent with with the thermal segregation model, because we do expect there to be more water ice as you get colder towards the higher latitudes. So slide 77 is sort of summarizing these things that I was just saying here. So maybe I won't go into them too much. But 78, at low latitudes, and this is one thing that I guess I actually didn't go into too much, but region 2 and region 3 that we pulled out here so far do have varying amounts of water ice evidently present. And this could actually, even in region 1, there could be fresh, bright craters with exposed water ice that we just are not, that are below the resolution of the images there, and so we don't know that they're present, but that could be the source of the water ice. It doesn't have to be volatiles mixed in with the dark material, but both are options here. If it is volatiles mixed in with the dark material, then that would suggest that, it's a recent process that's happening here, although that may not be entirely consistent with the time scales that we're talking about with the thermal segregation and the temperatures. So just to kind of conclude on the UVIS results is that we still have a lot to do with the data because we got such a big and great data set, so we're still working on it. But we're using the data set to map out water ice and to look into the thermal segregation, and also to look into the non-water ice materials and how the color varies across this dark hemisphere, and to look at compositional variations and see if that tells us about the exogenic material compared to the endogenic material. But generally, the data are consistent with John Spencer's thermal segregation model. And that's it for UVIS.
Okay, great. Do we have any questions right now? Okay, we'll save all the questions for the end then. Steve, are you online?
Can you hear me?
We can.
All right.
Go right ahead.
Okay, could I have, let's see, this is slide number 81. We're now going to change gears a lot because radar is sensitive to different physical phenomena than the optical techniques. And in many cases, there are factors involved that we really don't have to worry about with optical remote sensing. And perhaps all of this stems from the fact that the radar wavelength is macroscopic. The Cassini radar wavelength is 2.2 centimeters, a little bit less than an inch. We also have some ground-based radar data that turn out to be very important from Arecibo, working at a longer wavelength, about 13 centimeters. Now, on this first slide, I'm plotting an albedo, a reflectivity, and I'm showing some of the results that we have from radar. They're the small symbols. And I'm also showing the optical geometric albedos, and they're the large circles. And everything is plotted as a function of distance from Saturn. And you can see that things get brighter as we get closer to Saturn, regardless of whether we're talking about radar or optical technique. With the little symbols, you can see there's a fair amount of spread, and only a fraction of the available data are plotted here because we're in the midst of reducing it, we're in the midst of refining our calibration. So virtually everything I show you today is a little bit of a work in progress. However, you can see that there's this wonderful correlation between the optical and the radar albedos. You start out on the left with Mimas, and then you go up a little bit with Enceladus and down a little bit for Tethys. Then you drop down a little bit for Dione and Rhea, go on to Hyperion, finally to Iapetus and Phoebe. So there's a pattern here, and because the optical albedo is sensitive to dark, optically dark material, the optically dark material has to play some role in the radar albedos, but it is not the only role, not necessarily the only role, and probably not the only role. So let me talk a little bit about what is going on with the radar scattering from these icy surfaces. And this is now on slide 82. Ice is not reflective at radar wavelengths. It has a low dielectric constant, if all the satellites of Saturn were just icy spheres, homogeneous icy spheres, then the radar albedos on the previous slide would all be down by the horizontal axis. So something else is going on. And what's going on is multiple scattering. It turns out that ice is possibly the most transparent, geologically important material that exists in the solar system. Radio waves just don't get absorbed when they travel through pure water ice. What this means is that if you have a surface that has heterogeneities of any sort, whether you have particles or you have density variations or you have gradients, as long as you have some kind of heterogeneity anywhere near the scale of the wavelength, then the incident wave will come in and it will be refracted and it will be reflected and it will bounce around, but it will not be absorbed. And sooner or later, there's a good probability that it's going to exit in the direction from whence it came. And this is why clean icy surfaces in the solar system, on Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, and throughout the Saturn system, are much brighter than they'd be if we were just looking at a homogeneous ice surface. We're seeing structure as well as the effect of composition, namely the purity of the ice. So in general, if we have very pure ice, we see a very bright radar response, and as the ice gets dirtier, from whatever cause, the radar albedo drops. That's what's going on. And in a nutshell, this is the context that we use to try to understand the radar echoes from icy satellites in the Jupiter and Saturn systems, as well as icy surfaces at the poles of Mercury and Mars and certain other places as well. So let's go on to slide 83, which has a table which conveys the severity of the reduction in transparency when you put anything into water ice. You can put terrestrial rocks, you can put non-metallic meteorites, you can add lunar soil, you can put in ammonia, you can have organics, you can have trace amounts of nanophase iron, which is a possibility. Almost anything is going to drop the absorption length, not just a little, but a lot, by orders of magnitude. So we are hypersensitive at radar wavelengths to ice purity. Now let's go to the next slide. Which shows, this should be slide number 84 right now. And these are the Iapetus results that we have condensed into a little table. We know two things. First is, at 2 centimeters, at the Cassini wavelength, there's a tremendous dichotomy, more than a factor of 2, between the radar albedo of the optically dark leading side material and the optically bright trailing side material. So we see this dichotomy, it just jumps right out at us. And I'll give you some details in a moment. So that's the first row of the table. But then we just go up a factor of about 6 or so in wavelength, and all of the interesting properties of Iapetus vanish. We no longer see the dichotomy in a pronounced fashion. There may be a hint of it, but the albedos drop on all over the place. And if someone showed me the echoes at 13 centimeters from Iapetus and said, well, what object is this? I'd say, well, this is a perfectly ordinary main belt asteroid in every single respect. So what's going on? What's going on is the 13 centimeter wavelength is getting deeper, a factor of 5 or 6 deeper than the 2 centimeter wavelength. So how do we understand this? Let's go to slide number 85. We can understand these results if there's something in the uppermost part of Iapetus' surface that is degrading the transparency of ice. Now, my first guess was ammonia, back when we first saw this phenomenon a couple of years ago, because we know that ammonia has to exist in the Saturn system, certainly in concentrations much higher than we see in the Jupiter system, and that we know that ammonia has a tremendous effect in reducing the transparency of ice. However, it isn't necessarily what's going on. Another possibility is virtually anything from the previous table. Any kind of silicate or organic or metal, almost any kind of contaminant, including whatever the dark material on the apatis is made out of. But there's a lot less of it, whatever it is, in the uppermost part of the surface than when you get down deeper. And when I say down deeper, I have to hedge my bets because this is a complicated scattering process. By deeper, I could mean a few decimeters, or it could be a few meters, but I think it's in that realm. So, through the eyes of radar, the uppermost part of the surface of Iapetus is clean everywhere. However, the leading side is dirtier than the trailing side, at least down to depths of a few decimeters. You have to be talking at least in a few decimeters, a scale of a few decimeters when you have a wavelength of a couple of centimeters, because you've got to have enough thickness for the multiple scattering to really happen and give us the echoes that we see. But once you get down deeper, perhaps a few meters, something else is going on, and we don't know what it is. My best guess, I think, still is that there's ammonia underneath the optically seen surfaces of the Saturnian satellites, because we see this kind of phenomenon to some degree on other Saturn satellites. If there is ammonia underneath the surface, but not right at the surface, then you're going to quench the radar signal, and indeed the icy object is going to look like a typical main belt asteroid, so that could be what's going on. You can have a distance dependence of the removal of ammonia from the surface because you have micrometeoroid cratering impacts that get more severe as you go inward towards Saturn, and you also have magnetospheric effects like sputtering, at least once you get inside around Titan. So we're seeing under the surface, not the surface per se. We're seeing things at macroscopic scales, and there are various phenomena that can be going on to explain what we're seeing. Let me go to the next slide. Now I want to move to the issue of spatial resolution. Up until Iapetus 49, virtually all radar observations of icy bodies in the solar system did not have two-dimensional resolution. Instead of having resolution of the radar echo in range and Doppler, we had it just in Doppler. So we have spent the last 3 decades looking at echo spectra, which are like one-dimensional images, scans of radar brightness taken through a slit held parallel to the apparent spin vector, as you see on the left of this slide number 86. And that's all we've had, echo power spectra, and then we add up all the echo in the spectrum, and we convert that to a radar albedo. With Cassini, and let's go to the next slide, number 87, many of our observations of the satellites have used a beam large as or larger than the disk of the object, but in a few cases, including the situation with Iapetus, we've used a beam that is smaller than the disk, one-half or one-third or even smaller than the diameter of the disk, and this is how we've discerned the heterogeneity of the radar albedo on the object. Let's go to slide 88. For Iapetus 49, we finally got close enough to an icy satellite where we could do the same kind of imaging that's used for the mapping of Titan using the Cassini radar. Now, the geometry was a little bit different, so we didn't get quite the resolution that we get on a nice Titan SAR flyby, but we do have two-dimensional resolution of much of the dark side of the Iapetus. Our pixels are typically rectangular with one dimension as fine as 2 kilometers across and the other several times that. So the Doppler resolution is typically 6 kilometers, and the range resolution goes from about 2 to 12, as you can see from the diagram on the left of slide number 88. During the flyby, we did a kind of a raster scan up and down, doing some turns, going across the dark side, building up an image of the object, and we'll go to slide 89, which is a schematic that shows on the left an ISS, an optical map of the Iapetus. Now, this is from December of 2005. The vertical line shows the limit of the high-res ISS imaging of the Iapetus during flyby number 49. And on the right is a preliminary version of the radar SAR image. With radar, in order to produce a map, you have to have a very good table of distances and motions for the object that you're looking at. In other words, you need an ephemeris for the object. And the demands on the ephemeris are much greater for radar, especially for radar imaging, than they are for other techniques. So we're using the information from the Iapetus 49 flyby to produce a better ephemeris. The mission is almost finished with this, and then we'll be able to properly focus our data, and we'll really see what kind of information we have in the image. Similarly, we do not have a good calibration for this image yet, but it is coming, and we should have all that information within a month. Nonetheless, you can look back and forth, left and right, from this slide number 89, and you can see that there's a high degree of correlation between the structure through the eyes of radar and through the optical remote sensor. So virtually anything that you can find on one side, you can find on the other, although the appearance is very different. And the reason for that is that with radar, we're a little bit more sensitive to large-scale structure, and also the radar scattering law might be different from the optical scattering law. But also, we are seeing underneath the surface. So the radar is seeing a surface which here is probably as deep as a meter, and radar is sensitive to phenomena that involve different physics from what the optical sensors are sensitive to. In particular, the cleanliness of the ice. So we have structure and composition, and we have compositional effects that might be a little bit strange. Hence, if you look at the large basin that's prominent on the left, you see that basin on the right in the SAR image, but you see a lot of brightness. Now, where does this brightness come from? It could come about because the reflectivity is intrinsically brighter. In other words, the ice could be underneath the surface could be cleaner than the surroundings. Or it could come about because the geometry just conspires more in this basin than in other places to produce slopes that are facing the radar and hence giving brighter reflections. Or you could have a different distribution of ejecta, of small wavelength-sized icy rocks in this basin region than you have elsewhere in the dark terrain. It could be any weighted bunch of contributions from all those possibilities. This is an uncalibrated image on the right, so it's difficult at this point to try to go further in identifying exactly the correlation between radar bright and dark versus optical bright and dark. That's obviously one of the primary things we want to do, but we have to wait for a better calibration. What you're looking at on the right is the first radar image of an icy object in the solar system for which we also have good high-resolution optical images. So we've been waiting 30 years to have this kind of a data set. Certainly, what it establishes right off the bat, even before the focusing and calibration, is that we see a great deal of the structure on the surface through the eyes of radar. The fact that we're going down a meter isn't going to affect our ability to see craters that are many kilometers or tens of kilometers in size. And so we have a newfound confidence, an observational confidence, in the ability of synthetic aperture radar to see the surface of an icy object, even one that's covered with an atmosphere like Titan. So we now have even more confidence than we had before in the validity of our interpretation of the images that we've gotten through the eyes of the Cassini radar for Titan. Of course, we don't see anywhere near the number of craters on Titan that we see on Iapetus. Let me go to one more slide, and that's the final slide, which shows scatterometry, radar scatterometry, which is low spatial resolution, but it is very easy to calibrate, and the calibration is almost instantaneous. And what we see here, the red is bright and the blue is dark, we see good correlation between radar bright-dark and optical bright-dark, except for there's an incursion of the radar bright terrain right on top of the prominent basin that we see optically. There's some work to be done to make sure that this is true. However, if it is true, it does require an explanation that will undoubtedly be some combination of structural ideas and compositional ideas. So this is a status report. What the radar data do give us is a kind of leverage, a kind of insight into what's going on underneath the surface. And just coincidentally, the radar wavelength of the Cassini instrument is ideal for trying to understand what's going on with the redistribution of ice on this object, with the vertical profiles of ice versus dark material. And because we're seeing down into the surface, we're also seeing, at least in some sense, into the past. And so we're hoping that we're going to be able to constrain the situation with the Iapetus now and also how it got that way. I think I'll stop there.
Okay. Let's go ahead and open it up to questions. Remember to press star 6 if you're muted. Actually, I guess I do have a question since I've got all of you online here. You know, before we got to Saturn, it's sort of the bright-dark dichotomy was the big question, and then there's the ridge and whether it went all the way around and what created it is the big question. What do you guys think now is sort of the big open question for Iapetus?
Well, I think we still don't know where the dark material comes from.
What that exogenic source is.
Yeah, we have plausible ideas. On the thermal segregation model, it could be that most of the dark material we see on the surface is actually from inside the surface layers of Iapetus, and it's simply concentrated there by thermal segregation that's triggered by material falling from outside. But we're still not sure what that trigger material is, whether it's coming from Phoebe or the other outer moons or from interplanetary space. So that's still very much up in the air. And we still don't understand the equatorial ridge. To me, is still a big mystery, and I'm hoping that further analysis of the Cassini data will help us make more sense of that, but it's a very bizarre thing.
This is Greg Cermak. There was an article published earlier regarding the ridge and the fact that it was molten at one time and seemed to freeze early on into its current form. Can you elaborate on that?
I could have a go at that. Yeah, that's not so much about the equatorial ridge as about the equatorial bulge, which is a different thing. As in addition to this quite narrow ridge that runs around the equator of Iapetus, the whole shape of Iapetus is out of round. It's quite fat at the equator compared to its polar dimensions, and it's the shape it would be if it was spinning with, instead of a 79-day period, with, I think, about a 17-hour period. So it's as though it was once spinning very fast, and it was quite soft inside, so it bulged out to come into equilibrium with that speed, but then it froze in that position, in that state, and then slowed down. And so it has this fossil bulge, as we call it, this large out-of-roundness, which is not consistent with its current rotation rate. And so So that requires a very specific timing of the events during the cooling of it, that it had to have been soft enough to get into that shape in the first place, and then it had to be hard enough to keep that shape as it spun down, and also had to be soft enough to spin down tall. If it was really frozen solid very early on, it would not have spun down, and it would still be spinning in a non-synchronous way.
What actually causes the slowdown of rotation?
That's caused by the tides of Saturn acting on Iapetus. And it's the same thing, the tides of the Earth acting on our moon cause the moon to always show the same face towards the Earth. It's the same thing on Iapetus with Saturn. But those tides are really very weak on Iapetus because it's so far from Saturn. So Saturn's tidal effects have a very small effect, and so you need very specific circumstances for those actually to stop it rotating or put it in synchronous rotation as it is today.
There were also some comments earlier in the slides about iron oxides being present. That might be a possible source for the darker materials. Do you have any idea where that might originate from?
Maybe Roger can take that.
Well, I'm trying to think. I don't recall anybody saying iron oxides per se. Vince does not.
Maybe Steve Ostro said something about nanophase iron.
Oh, nanophase iron is very different. And in fact, the very linear spectrum of the dark material of Iapetus looks very similar to nanophase iron. So, yes, there could very well be nanophase iron there.
Okay. Thank you.
Do we have any other questions? We had gotten an email question from someone called Matt Miller. I don't know if he's on. But maybe I'll read the question, and anybody who wants to answer can chime in. And that way Matt can get his answer when he listens to the audio. Matt Mills, sorry. Who's an amateur astronomer. And his question is, could the strange appearance of Iapetus be due to a gamma ray burst and then subsequent capture of the moon by Saturn's gravity long after the event?
I think that's speculation at this point.
I suppose the idea is that the intense radiation from a gamma ray burst would darken the ice on one side. I suppose you can imagine something like that, but it would be not clear why Iapetus would be the only object to be dark on one side, because the gamma ray burst would have affected everything in the solar system. Then also why it would have been captured in such an orientation that dark spot was exactly facing forward in its orbit. So I think that it's a bit of a long shot.
So are there any upcoming Iapetus observations that you guys are looking forward to?
You know what Tillman is doing a lot of is observations of the outer dark moons that are even exterior to Phoebe, I think sometimes, just to see if the color is going to match at all from what ISS images tell us.
We don't have any more close flybys of Iapetus for the rest of the mission. And we don't even have any as close as the New Year 2005 flyby. And so there'll be other opportunities to look at it, but they'll be very distant and the images will not be very sharp, but they may still allow us to look in particular lighting conditions or particular angles that we haven't seen yet. So there'll still be valuable stuff to come. But this was the big one, and there'll be nothing that good in the future unless in some later part of the mission there's a decision made to go back to Iapetus. The extended mission, which extends through from the middle of 2008 till the middle of 2010, does not include any Iapetus flybys, which was a disappointment, but there wasn't really any way to fit that in, so we weren't going back in that period. But it's conceivable, probably not very likely, but conceivable that after the middle of 2010 there might be an opportunity to go back.
Okay, does anybody have any final questions? Okay, well, with that, we'll say thank you to our scientists. We really appreciate you guys taking the time to come and share with us your exciting IAPIDUS results. Everyone was really looking forward to the IAPIDUS flyby all these years, so it's been a pretty exciting month for everybody. And Amanda, do you have an advertisement for the next Charm Telecon?
Let's see, what is the date? It's the last Tuesday of November.
Right, the 27th.
And the topic is going to be Titan's Lakes,
wow, great.
Yeah.
And then also just a reminder to everybody online that we typically take the month of December off, so there will be no Charm Telecon in December. And with that, we'll close it out, and thanks again to everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.